You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at wicn.org. Good evening. This is The Public Eye. I'm Al Vona, your host. Before we get started this evening, I just want to remind folks that we are in the midst of our Heart of Jazz Fund Drive, and it's important that everyone who's made a WICN contribution over the years hopefully continues to do so, because every gift, whether it's $25 or $250, makes a big difference for us. Listener support is essential. If you're listening right now and you haven't become a donor, know that your gift will have an important impact on this radio station. If you already are a donor, as I said, thank you. You help keep WICN secure by trusting us to bring you the music you love and service our incredible community. So please, go to WICN.org and make your gift right now. Thank you so much. And back to our show. This week, I'm joined by best-selling author Elsa Hoonesson. And she is the author of the new book, Being Seen, One Deafblind Woman's Fight to End Ableism. And I think nobody would know better than Elsa of the difficulties of growing up, not being able to hear. And I'm sure, as she writes in the book, many times walking and wondering if someone is calling out her name, or if she can hear the horn of a car as she enters a crosswalk, things that many of us take for granted. And she's put all these emotions between the pages of her brand new book. And for the next half hour, we'll be talking with Elsa. Elsa, nice to have you with us.
Thanks for having me on.
So many people, you know, I was thinking about your book, and I'm thinking if for any reason, I mean, if I get a hangnail, I don't want to tell anybody. I'm just kind of, I guess that's, some people would say, well, geez, Vona, that's kind of being vain. But you really, it took some guts to put between the pages of the book, one, your personal feelings, and secondly, probably the feelings and the emotions that many people, you know, deaf and blind, go through. What prompted you to want to put it all out there?
Well, I've been working in the field of disability justice and disability activism since I was in my early 20s. And one of the things that I've discovered is that most non-disabled people don't understand what it's like to live in a disabled body. And that is one of the major causes of the misunderstandings between non-disabled people and disabled people. And so when I started to write about the ways in which media portrays disability, I realized that I would have to put down my own experience in order to demystify a lot of those myths that people believe very strongly about what it's like to be deaf and blind.
Has the experience of doing just that? I mean, obviously, you grew up, you know, with the disability, so it's made it it made it a challenge, no question about it. But since putting forth those emotions, and I know you do a lot of, I know you do a lot of workshops. I know you speak before groups, certainly inspirational. But many people, I would think, putting this all out there gives you an added strength. Is that fair to say?
I actually think sometimes it's a bit of a disadvantage. People, like you use the word inspiring, and when people feel inspired by your disabled body, they actually start to disengage from the reality of what it's actually like. So what will happen is they'll say, oh, Elsa, you're so inspiring. You do all of these different things. You're not actually disabled. And the minute that people start to separate my disability from my actual lived experience is when they stop respecting that I actually have a disability. So that's part of why it's so important for me to talk about this, because that tension is part of that challenge.
I can remember, I don't mean to cut you off, but you mentioned this in the liner notes for the book, that one of the inspirations was indeed Helen Keller, and that name I think is pretty synonymous with many, many people. In fact, Patty Duke had done a movie many years ago on the life of Helen Keller. And if you watch that film, if you read the books on Helen Keller, you realize, you know, the challenges that she had to go through and the difficulties. But at the end, she was able to overcome to the point where she functioned on a daily basis, inspired so many people. So, I mean, it must be a good feeling, though, Elsa, is what I'm getting at, when you do work with a group of people who are blind or deaf, and they see what you do, travel the country, write books. It's got to be quite a real catalyst for them, right?
I mean, my message to fellow deaf and blind people is that we don't need to overcome our bodies. We need to work with them. Helen Keller certainly did a lot to learn how to work within her own body. And she also was mythologized. And I want to call out that the miracle worker mythologizes her experience pretty heavily. So when I think about talking about Helen Keller or about sort of that overcoming narrative, what I actually think about is that Helen Keller learned how to work within her own body system, which is the same thing that I tell other deafblind people. We don't have to work within the non-disabled framework within our bodies. We have to work within our own framework, within our own body system. And that's actually what I do. I work within my body. I work within what I can do and how I experience the world. So I'm not trying to overcome it. I'm trying to work with it.
So now you've accepted that, you, as you said, and I couldn't agree with you more, the fact that, hey, you can't do more than what your body is able to do, you know, the energy that you're given on any given day. But with that said, now that's inspiration on your end. Has it been a difficult road over the years, especially in terms of employment or working within groups? I know you're also an educator. Have people come full circle in accepting disabilities such as yours, or are they still somewhat reluctant to bring someone on board?
It took me 11 and a half years to get a day job. I was a freelancer for 11 and a half years when I finished my graduate degree, and I just got my first ever full-time day job in 2021. So, yeah, it's been difficult. People don't want to hire disabled people. People don't want to change their perception of what a disabled person can do. And I think those perceptions are pretty heavily linked to television and film and what they've seen or perceived about that disability. So, yeah, it's definitely a challenge, but the challenge is where other people's perceptions come into play. I think that's really where my book wanted to go. Was it's not a book for disabled, well, it is a book for disabled people because disabled people need to be seen, but in many ways it's a book for non-disabled people to have their perceptions taken and reformed so that they can be better allies.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I in reading the book, I mean, I didn't get the sense that, you know, as you said, it's not a how-to. This was a book of acceptance. Learn that people with these disabilities are really no different. Same emotions, you know, the same wants and needs and goals as everybody else. And if we just took a step back and understood that, I mean, like you said, 11 years to get that job. I mean, that seems unconscionable to me, in spite of all the laws that are on the books and everything else. But with that said, the once you got in that role, once you got the employment, the full time job, did they actually see that you could put out as much as anybody else, that you were an asset to the organization, and that any fears or any apprehensions should be shelved?
I think it depends. I mean, on a day-to-day basis, my particular team is amazing. But I don't know what some of my coworkers are thinking. And I think it's kind of hard to speak to whether or not some people do doubt how much I'm doing. Because even when I've worked in contract positions or when I've worked in volunteer positions, there is sometimes an undercurrent with some people, even when other people are doing just fine. So I don't want to speak too much on that because I can't actually control how people perceive me or always know necessarily what people are saying or thinking. What I can tell you is that I'm doing great at my day job.
Well, yeah, and it sounds it. I mean, I can sense the enthusiasm. I don't sense any reluctance. Like, you know, oh, I got to go to work today, and so many people that you know without disabilities say that on a daily basis. So I get the sense that you're elated. This is exciting. It's a new chapter in your life. And I think that's good not only for you personally, but I think it's inspiration for anybody, whether they have a disability or not. How about in the education sphere? I mean, you get young people in front of you. Has that been a different audience to address as opposed to the average American picking up the book and reading it?
I mean, I love working with specifically elementary school groups. I don't get to do it very often, but when I do, that's a real opportunity to change our society for the better, because kids are so often being told that they don't get to see disabled kids, or don't play with that disabled kid, or don't look at that disabled adult in the grocery store. And when I come into a classroom with a bunch of elementary schoolers, I get to say, hey, I'm a deafblind person. It's really nice to meet you. What do you want to know about what it's like to be me? And their curiosity actually gets to become engaged. They actually get to ask questions, many questions that they're not usually allowed to ask. And that opportunity is always really exciting to me, because I think that kids are learning more about disability than when I was a kid.
Oh, no question about it. Yeah.
Yeah. And so even though my book never reaches children, it shouldn't. it's not a book for kids. The opportunity to talk to children is always one of the ones I jump at. And I'm also a mom. So I genuinely have to have those conversations on a daily basis.
Right. With that said, Elsa, are your children at all have any afflictions with deaf or blindness in any way?
No. As I talk about in my book, my disability is not congenital.
Okay.
It's congenital rubella. So I was born with this blindness and heart condition due to my mother having rubella when she was pregnant with me.
And that certainly was the tipping point. Going back to the children, though, because this is very interesting. I think it's so important, and I want to get your sense on this, that you expose them to this at an early age so that there is no preconceived, for lack of a better word, people don't draw conclusions in early age, conclusions that they hold all their life. I think if young children are exposed to this, they hear you talk, they see you function just like they do, there's perhaps more acceptance. Does that sound plausible?
I think so. I mean, I think what it is, it's less that I operate the same way that they do, and more that seeing a variety of bodies helps kids to not feel like there is one kind of normal body. Like, if you introduce children to the concept of wheelchairs and wheelchair users really early on, and you just talk about it like it's normal, and like this is just a way of being, instead of saying, oh, look at that poor person with a wheelchair, they can't use their legs.
Right.
What you're doing is you're telling kids, this is okay, this is normal, this is something to be celebrated. And then you're not creating a pity circle. And you're not making it look like that person is somebody that they don't want to be like. Because going back to what we were talking at the beginning, being disabled is something that a lot of people are really afraid of. They don't want to think about it because they're afraid of becoming disabled. They don't want to talk about it because they're afraid of being disabled.
Right.
And that fear turns into pity, and that fear also turns into hatred or loathing. And so getting kids early to look at disabled bodies as something to be excited about and curious about and engaged with, instead of being sad or pitying them, actually changes that dynamic.
Something you just said caught my interest. On average, you would, and I would agree with you that most people see somebody either in a wheelchair or with crutches or blind and deaf. You know, the first thing most people think is, you know, sympathy or pity, as you said. I never realized that in some cases, because we all fear our vulnerabilities, we all fear, not being who we are today for whatever reason, could in some cases with some people build animosity that could turn into, you know, like you said, they actually have a dislike. Have you experienced that firsthand, that people at first, because of that fear that you talked about in the, you know, for themselves, sort of hold it against you?
Absolutely. 100%. That's part of what I think happens when people are hostile to me in the street. I've had moments where I will be looking at my cell phone while holding my white cane, and people will curse at me or say I'm not really blind. They'll try to police whether or not I experience my body in the way that I do. They don't know me. Mm. They don't know what's happening. But because they think they have a right to know, or because they think that they can know because they're sighted and I'm not, or because they think that you can't look at a cell phone if you're blind, I experience that hatred and that, frankly, violence.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's almost unconscionable. I until reading your book, I never would have given it a second thought. I mean, myself, I was always taught by my parents, you know, if there's a disabled person and, like I said, they're in front of you, or there's a line of folks, let them go first. Mm-hmm. If they're crossing a street, give them time to get into the street, themselves, so they safely cross the street. But the idea that it can pivot the other way to the point where people are actually, violent is, it's almost like, how is this possible? Has that been difficult for you?
I mean, sure. It's made me feel much more unsafe by being by myself in many situations. And I'm a disabled adult. I have things I need to do on my own. So having that concern or fear doesn't help me do things like go grocery shopping. Uh-huh. It does affect my real life.
And how about traveling? I mean, I know you do a lot of traveling. The few times that I go away in the course of a year, it's like I need a vacation from the vacation or the trip, because I can't stand, you know, airports. It's congested. It's crowded. People are so anxious. And like you said, they're even rude to folks like myself. You know, get out of my way. Let me get my bag. I've got a taxi to catch. I have an appointment, blah, blah, blah. So I can't even, you know, I guess what I'm asking is, has it drained some of that vibrant vitality that you have, that gives you that energy to go out? I mean, have you ever sat there on a Monday morning and just said, that's it, done with the travel, done with, you know, talking with groups, because, you know, there's a percentage out there that just makes life so miserable, or have you found some mechanism to overcome that?
I mean, I would tell you that, honestly, the thing that makes travel the hardest for me is the security checkpoints, because they're incredibly overwhelming. When you are deaf and blind and the rules sometimes change from airport to airport, and communication is through shouting in a large space where there are lots of people who are all talking, and there's lots and lots and lots of bodies, and you have to take off your shoes and remove things from your bags.
Yeah.
That is the worst part of travel for me.
Yeah.
And I still do it, because at the end of the day, going and talking to people in person or getting to go with my husband on a trip, those things are the best parts of my time.
Do you do, when in that same vein, also, of traveling or just speaking before groups, do you often travel alone?
I do.
Oh.
Yeah, I travel by myself pretty frequently.
Wow.
And I have since I was a kid. I've been traveling by myself since I was 9 or 10 years old.
Mm. Courage. I give you a lot of credit, because, like you said, just going through a checkpoint at an airport, it's like, okay, you know, where's my wife and my daughter? Can somebody give me some instructions here? I mean, kudos to you on that front. But again, it goes back to what you talk about in the book, and the basis of all of that is, and you, as I said, it's not a how-to book. It's a nope. Look. It's a look inside me book, and it sounds like for many years, you've often sat there, maybe looked in the mirror and just said, you know, or just contemplated, okay, this is what it is. This is what I've been given. And I can sit here and mope around all day long, or I can make the best of it and go on with my life and live as fulfilling a life as I have. And it sounds like you've come full circle, right?
I mean, I think so. I think there was a time in my life when, because of the way that society treats disabled people, it was really hard to imagine a world in which I could be doing what I'm doing now. And I think that a lot of what I had to do was work past that ableism that I was experiencing and find a path forward, not just on my own, but with community and with people that wanted to support me and wanted to have me in their lives and wanted me to not just be in their lives, but to thrive in community with them.
Yeah. And it sounds by all signs that you've done, at least from my perspective, you know, writing a book, traveled all over the country, educating people, inspiring people. I mean, that's not somebody who sits there and, wallows, as they say, in self-pity. You've decided to take a stand and move on with your life. In the few moments that we have left, Elsa, let me ask you, what's next? What challenges are you really, you know, what's on that bucket list?
Well, I'm working on my next book. I am hoping to sell some more fiction as well. I've got a short story that's coming out soon. And I'm really proud to share that this year, Being Seen did win the Washington Book Award for nonfiction. Mm. So I'm hoping that that will give me some space to talk to more communities about what it's like to be deafblind and hopefully change some of the media that's out there, because the media truly is what's causing a lot of people to misunderstand disability. So that's one of the big ones for me.
Yeah, and I love the title. I mean, Being Seen. Did you come up with that on your own?
I did. It went through about three different title iterations, and that one was the one that stuck.
Yeah, well, you know, and it's—I say that only because it's apropos for the, for the content of the book, and how you wrote the book and what you wrote about being seen. Hey, here I am. Take me or leave me. I'm comfortable with me, and I'm going to live my life to the fullest in spite of, as you said, media skewing things a certain way. And I can only imagine, Elsa, that today with the 24/7 news cycle and the social media that's just bombards people nonstop, that's made it even harder for you, right?
I mean, it certainly made things more interesting. There are days when the media news, like the 24-hour news cycle, as you call it, is focused on disability. And in those moments, not only am I frustrated by what's being said, but also frequently I end up having to re-educate people during that 24-hour cycle.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the hard part. You know, you've made some gains, and then it's like one step forward, two backwards. But once again though, Elsa, you've overcome that. I mean, nobody can sit there and say, you know, look at her. She sits there feeling bad for herself. From all signs, that's not who you are at all.
It's funny that you say that, though, because some of the one-star reviews of the book are people saying I have a very large chip on my shoulder. So
Seems
like you certainly read the book as it's intended, but not everybody does.
Well, you know, you gotta as you're reading the book, you have to stop every few chapters. I did anyway, and think, okay, I'm not deaf or blind. But I have other things going on in my personal life or about me that's not perfect either. And I can sit here and choose to beat myself up, but there'll be enough people because, you know, 7 billion people on this planet, not everyone is going to be your best friend. But it takes really a lot of courage to overcome that first and foremost. With the few moments we have left, if people want to reach out to you directly, pose questions to you, get more information about your work and appearances, how might they do that?
So you can find me on snarkbat.com, S-N-A-R-K-B-A-T. That's also how you can find me on Twitter. I engage with my followers pretty regularly, and there's a lot of discussion about disability and ableism to be found there as well. So those are the two spots you can find me, and you can also attend readings and book events that get posted on my website anytime this year.
And you don't, as I said, and Elsa would, I'm sure, Elsa, you would agree that you don't need to be blind or deaf to engage. This book is really for everybody because it's inspirational. As I said right from the outset, this is not a how-to book. It's about personal feelings, a memoir, if you will, on Elsa's life. Again, I want to thank my guest this week, Elsa Hoonesson. The book is Being Seen, One Deaf-Blind Woman's Fight to End Ableism. Any questions about the broadcast, you can certainly give us a call here at the studios at WICN. Our main number is 508-752-0700. You can pose any comments, questions to me directly. I certainly welcome that. That's Al Vona, V-U-O-N-A, at WICN.org. As I said earlier, too, we are in the midst of our fun drive, the Heart of Jazz fun drive, that is. And we welcome new members. We welcome and thank existing members. So you know, as they say, open your hearts, open your wallets, and please donate today and make sure that this fine radio station is still a big part of the Central Mass community. For the Public Eye, this is Al Vona. Thank you so much for tuning in.